And we are live in the studio this morning. It is 10.02 a.m. We have some wonderful people from out on campus here with us today, and we're going to have a gigantic discussion. Or a small discussion. And we're going to be talking about Pride, we're going to be talking about queer issues, and who better to discuss that than people from SFU's own out on campus. So to start things off, we're just going to go around and introduce ourselves.
I'm Emma, and I'm an out on campus collective member and volunteer.
I'm Susan. I volunteered out on campus as well.
I'm Brittany, and I volunteered on campus, but I also work at the Women's Center.
And I'm Craig. I am currently coordinator at Out on Campus, former volunteer.
Wonderful. And I'll be your moderator today. I'm Sarah, and I'm the programming coordinator at CJSF here in the studio. So, Craig, as the coordinator of Out on Campus, can you give us a brief introduction to what Out on Campus is and the role that Out on Campus plays at SFU?
Of course. Well, what is Out on Campus, you ask? Out on Campus is Simon Fraser University's Center for Lesbian, Gay, Transgendered, and Bisexual People and their allies. Throughout the semester, we do a lot of different things. For example, we offer lots of programming events and resources. For example, workshops on sex, sexuality, and gender. We run discussion groups. We have awareness campaigns on campus using posters and events such as Transgender Day of Remembrance and Queer Awareness Week. We will be talking later about one of our poster campaigns, actually. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, Out on Campus is a safe space at SFU. We welcome all students of all genders and sexualities, whether you identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, intersex, straight, two-spirited, cisgendered, HIV, AIDS, positive, queer, questioning, butch, femme, ally, genderqueer. The list just really goes on. So if you're human, you're welcome at Out on Campus, and you're protected by our safe space policies. And finally, just to describe Out on Campus physically, we have a great, comfy, comfortable, cozy lounge. We've just been renovated. Great new sofas, floors, everything. So come on in, check it out, swing by, and say hi.
Wonderful. And you have a great library as well.
We do.
I've always been very excited about the library. Things you will not find at the SFU library.
Exactly. We'll not find two naughty boys teaching you the ropes at the SFU library. So
I haven't seen that one yet.
It's worth a look.
And is it, you said any humans are welcome at SFU or at out on campus, so obviously students and staff and anyone.
Yeah, we're open for all students at SFU, open for staff, faculty, or anybody who just wants to drop by, say hi, ask questions, hang out, meet people, get resources or information. We are there for pretty much everyone.
Okay. And you've got a pretty exciting campaign going on right now. We're actually showing some of the posters that you've made here at CJSF. It's called the Got Queer campaign, which is sort of a mirror of the Got Milk campaign. And it's a pretty clever advertising thing that you've created. So tell us about the Got Queer campaign.
Well, how about one of our volunteers here tell us a little bit about the Got Queer campaign?
Yeah.
Well, the Got Queer campaign came out of a very strange little brainstorming session, or what turned into a brainstorming session in the lounge one day, where somebody just came up with the idea, and it sort of ballooned out from there. And so the posters now that are going up around campus, and that we will also be marching with in the Pride Parade this coming weekend, there's a set of 20 posters featuring different well-known celebrities who are generally queer of some description, although not exclusively. We do have Madonna is on our
Got Pride
poster. Jon Stewart is Got Ally. And they're all black and white posters, except for one part of them, which is a rainbow, kind of reminiscent of the Got Milk mustache. And in fact, one of the posters that we have is, in fact, Got Milk with a mustache, but it's featuring Harvey Milk. From San Francisco. So,
right.
And we've also got buttons. We've got a whole array of buttons that are so much fun to wear. I have about three of them on one bag. it's a really, really good campaign. I think it's going to make people really stop and look, and it's fun, and it's a really good awareness raising tactic. So if you see those around, take a look. Mm-hmm. There will be descriptions of the celebrities and their work and or orientation, a little bit of extra information that'll be going up on the website within the next little while, hopefully.
And you mentioned something in there about how it's a good campaign because it makes people stop and look. And just to throw this out to anyone around the table, how important is that to have a campaign that makes people stop and look and sort of take time out of their regular routine?
Well, personally, I think that awareness is one of the most important things for any minority or marginalized community to have, because it's much, much harder to really actively discriminate against somebody when you know people, when you are aware of just how human the other is.
I would have to agree. I mean, having somebody stop and look and think about something is a great change from people who are blissfully ignorant of the issues and the topics that are out there. With this campaign already, I've seen people stopping outside of our lounge, looking at the posters on our window outside, and just kind of like looking and seeing what's on there. And it's really great to see them stop and think about it. Same thing happened last year with Transgender Day of Remembrance, when we have the big poster campaign in the middle of Convocation Mall. And you see people walk past, and almost every time you walk past, there's somebody, at least one, if not like a dozen people, looking at the posters, stopping and seeing what's happening. And so people are actually starting to reflect on the issues. And it's really nice to have people become aware.
How has the response been to the posters?
Awesome.
Really, really good. Seem to really, really like the campaign, which I think really says something about the effectiveness of the medium.
Mm-hmm. And I think people really like the humor of the campaign, and like that I guess it's a really happy campaign. And it's kind of neat to see the different celebrities that actually do identify as queer. So, which is very different for example, from our Transgender Day of Remembrance poster campaign, tends to be quite more
serious
and depressing for obvious reasons. So it's nice to put some fun into
what I really like about the campaign, and forgive me if I'm like stepping on toes and being like, hey, I'm gonna talk now. what I really like about the campaign is the fact that we took a lot of care to make sure that all of the celebrities that we do feature self-identify as whatever it is we've put them as. And that is such an essential part, I think, of the entire campaign. We're not telling people what their identity is, we're showing people how other people identify. And I think that's great to show the kind of diversity even within the queer community. There's so much diversity in the queer community, and it often gets sort of overlooked.
Can you give us some examples of some of the ways that people self-identify, at least in terms of the posters in this campaign?
Well, I think the most surprising one for anybody was our Got Polly poster. Tilda Swinton, who's probably most well-recognized as a white witch in Narnia, but also everywhere from I Am Love, Orlando, Michael Clayton. She's in a ton of different movies. Usually as a small character, but she's becoming much more famous. Has two partners, an older fellow with whom she has children, and a younger fellow who tours around with her. And it's not one of those things that's often discussed in the celebrity realm, is a polyamorous relationship.
And her partners also have other partners.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see a celebrity in that kind of scenario. Other ones that you might not, I guess, Michel Foucault is identified as Got Paws, died at the time, AIDS-related death. So it's something that most people don't recognize or realize when they think of Foucault.
Mm-hmm. And there was one for Lady Gaga that said, Got Pansexual. And that's one that I'm still, turning around in my head, like, I have no idea what pansexual means.
Well, pansexual is a really interesting term that I quite like, but it's a bit like the term strictly queer within the queer community, but it mostly means attracted to the entire spectrum. And it's sort of a way of disbanding the gender binary, which is implied in a word like bisexual. For example, I personally, if I'm talking to people outside the queer community, bisexual is usually the easiest way to describe it, but I don't consider it accurate. Because, for example, my partner is transgender, and I know people who have genderqueer partners who, and more than that, people who are not attracted to the traditional version of male, traditional version of female, but are attracted to a wide range of identities and gender expressions.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And let's talk about the word queer as well. That's something some of our listeners may not even be familiar with, which is why and how the word queer has come, you know, to be used as a bit of a catch-all term, if I can go that far to say it, because I know historically, like, you know, myself and another queer person at work often have this debate about, like, I want to use queer, but, you know, she grew up in a culture where that was definitely, like, not an okay term. It was really used to hurt people. And, you know, we kind of debate about it a little bit. So tell us a little bit about that term.
Well, I think that it is difficult for some people to get a hold of the idea of using queer as something other than a pejorative. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important for marginalized groups to have the option of reclaiming a word. And I think that has definitely happened in, well, what I guess I would call the queer community now. And I always sort of default to calling it the queer community because it really communicates that it's outside of the mainstream. It's outside of what is considered the straight male-female norm. So I think that queer communicates a lot of variance, not just in gender identity or sexuality, but also, you know, even politically.
And the nice thing about something like a term queer is it can be used as a catch-all rather than having to refer to everything as, like, the LGBTTIQT2 community.
Right.
Like, so you get this huge alphabet soup in trying to really make sure that you recognize everybody who is a part of the queer community. And so it's a nice kind of summary, I guess, of the different identities that sexual and gender identities people can hold.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I really like about the term queer is that it is, I mean, it's a very much a term that is that people use to self-identify, either to self-identify in terms of their sexual orientation, but also even there are even straight people who use the term queer when they are part of, say, a leather or fetish community, or part of the polyamorous community, that where, although they may be attracted to primarily members of, well, the opposite sex, I hate calling it that, but primarily members at the opposite end of the gender spectrum, or the other end of the gender spectrum. However, they may still identify as queer because they identify outside of sort of that mainstream
monogamous
binary, anything else, and it's a term that I consider very inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Craig, did you have something you wanted to add?
The only thing I would add would be that queer is really great because it does also remove, like, the limits of the alphabet soup. Somebody who identifies perhaps as gay, but sleeps with a number of different partners, some of whom may be trans, might be imposing their sexuality onto the other partner's sexual or gender identity, I should say. And so by identifying as queer, it recognizes the fluidity of one's own sexuality and gender within your own identity with your relationships and partnerships and friendships. And as a whole, it's very inclusive, as Emma was saying, and it really just brings everybody together in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there are people within that, you know, large spectrum and that catch-all that may not identify with that specific term as queer, it still is a really great way to unify the community, I think. It's mm-hmm. just through that one word.
And once again, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM broadcasting from Burnaby, where we are currently having a live discussion with members of Out on Campus. And it is Pride Weekend coming up. So in honor of that, we're also going to be rebroadcasting this on Friday. So stay tuned for that. We're having 4 hours of Pride programming on this coming Friday. And it's going to be awesome. And if you're used to hearing Bioneers right now, it will be back next week. And we will be here on Friday again. So everything will be back to normal next week. And if you're tuning in for This Way Out at 10:30, we are going to be here for another half hour. And that will also be back next week. So, to move on to our next topic, recently The Peak published an article that got a lot of people in a tizzy, including myself. It was published by Sam Reynolds, who basically brought up the argument that the Women's Studies Department, or Gender Studies, is irrelevant, and, you know, the pirate radio course that was being taught, you know, was radio is dead, gender studies is dead, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, there's been a huge response to that, and let's talk about it. Anyone like to comment on
Well, I wrote, I just, so you know, I have my degree with an extended minor in women's studies, so obviously I was not pleased with this article. And I actually wrote a response in the Peak. But really, I think that having a women's studies and gender studies program on campus is super important because gender issues and women's issues, and especially issues around sexuality, don't get discussed in a lot of other departments. Most departments operate, or most courses that are offered operate on a hetero, white, masculine, or male norm, and courses that aren't going to be about the white male norm are usually demarked. So I think women's studies and gender studies is still part of the demarcation, but at least it gives a space and an opportunity for people to discuss issues around gender and sexuality, and also issues that are important to other marginalized communities. So without necessarily having to always say, like, oh, this is about women and this is about sexuality, it's kind of exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would also argue, and I really enjoyed your response in the Peak, Brittany, and I think that your point about the fact that most courses are, in fact, representing a norm that is not necessarily representative, I think is an important point, because there is sort of a general bias that assumes that when we take the courses that we take, for example, I'm in political science, we assume that those courses are unbiased and without an ideological basis or without a political bent, and they're not. And I would argue that it's very, very difficult to have an unideologically charged academic environment, as Sam Reynolds is accusing the gender and women's studies department of being very ideologically charged. And I would argue that, for example, in the political science, there are some classes and some professors which are a little bit more bent to the left, but the vast majority are based in the neoliberal capitalist norms that we see in day-to-day life. And just because that's what we normally see doesn't mean that it's without bias.
Mm-hmm.
I think a case in point with political science as well, about a year ago I took a stats class, and of course one of the survey questions we were supposed to ask was asking for somebody's gender, and our prof adamantly advocated for us to just have male and female as options, and our group, who happened to be doing a survey on campus, vehemently opposed him and said, no, we can't have like a strict, you know, binary selection system. So we actually left it as an open-ended question where people could identify wherever they wanted on the gender spectrum with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to fight against that norm within a department that isn't used to talking about other issues outside of their own, you know, specialty can be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great to be able to try and educate professors outside of, you know, the women's studies and gender studies departments, but it's a long process. And I think until we can get to the point where women's studies, gender studies, sexuality, and all such are fully integrated into everything else, there is definitely a need for women's studies and gender studies and sexuality studies in academia, because it's going to go unrecognized and unformalized.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to create their own opinions and norms, and it's going to exclude everybody else and their views from, you know, from the general discussions, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's really, really important for us to discuss things from more of a social justice perspective, especially in university, because while post-secondary education has this reputation for being super liberal, you know, and like students are such activists and whatever, mostly you see apathy and people aren't educating themselves about these issues. And I think I'm concerned that people think because they're in university, they're so much more, they've got, you know, a better idea of what, you know, the world is really like, when in reality we're taking courses that are reinforcing again and again this white male heterosexual lens, which is really unfortunate. I think there's a complete disregard for the kind of diversity in views that exists.
And where does that responsibility lie for becoming actually more aware and more educated? Does it lie with, you know, folks like out on campus to sort of go out and do outreach and educate a little bit? Or does it lie with people themselves to sort of wake up and be a little bit like, hey, there's other ways of living out there that might be different from what I'm used to?
I think that there's a balance that needs to be struck. I mean, on the one hand, people are not likely to know a lot about communities other than their own as a default. So on the one hand, minority communities can go out and do outreach and just provoke that awareness, or just a little, like a spark, anything, such as what the queer campaign is attempting to do. But at the same time, people, especially people in university who are here to learn how to critically think, need to start stepping outside of their box and thinking about things in new ways, or what's the point?
I think it's a hugely shared responsibility. I mean, there's definitely onus on the individual if, you know, they claim to be open-minded, or if they want to be open-minded and they want to see other viewpoints, then they need to take responsibility and do that. But there's also the awareness that a lot of people aren't doing that. And that's why I think organizations like Out on Campus are also really important to put awareness out there to get people thinking, even though I think people really need to be responsible for themselves, especially if they claim to be egalitarian, especially if they claim to be open-minded, to look into these things themselves and to consider them carefully.
Mm-hmm. I guess almost I wanted to bring it back to the Pride Parade coming up this weekend. A lot of people say, oh yeah, you know, they're really bright and loud and flamboyant and fabulous. Why are they so big and loud and colorful? But it's creating the awareness. It's drawing people's attention to the issues where they wouldn't otherwise have looked into them. And I think it's important for places like Out on Campus to actually be there to inform people, to create that awareness. And as Susan said, people are not taking the initiative on their own, so it's almost like we're stepping in for them and saying, hey, there's stuff going on. There's a lot that you may not be aware about. And it might feel like we're hitting over the head with a hammer constantly with all these like queer stuff, but it's important because they're not going to find out about it otherwise. It's not going to be represented in their classes. If they don't go out of their way to become involved and to educate themselves, they're not going to find anything out that way. So it's
right.
One of the many reasons
we're around. It's a combination of visibility and a lack of apathy on the part of students. Brittany, I know you were waiting to say something.
Yeah, I also have another point, which is just that I think it's also the responsibility of the university to make sure that these courses are offered and to make sure that the Women's Studies and Studies Department, the First Nations Department, more social justice departments, which are, I think, coming into question a lot, not only by Sam Reynolds, but also by the government, need to be supported by the university, not only with, like, financial resources, but also, you know, they need to support the deans of those departments, or the deans need to give support to those departments and things like that on a really personal level. And that also needs to happen, and that's a responsibility of the institution to which we attend. So not only is there individual responsibility, but there's also an institutional responsibility to ensure that these courses are taught, as well as a social responsibility on the part, for example, of Out on Campus, to make sure that at least some students can start, you know, questioning their own sexuality, have the space to do that, or have the space to look at other things.
I'd like to actually even just add to that point and say, you know, we're talking about whose responsibility is it to make sure that people are, that individuals are more aware of these things, and there is a balance there. But at the same time, I think it is very important to recognize that in fact, the individualism that is so much a part of our culture is important, but it is also part of an institution. And and the institution, in the more cultural sense of the word, they do tend to perpetuate themselves. And so I think it is important to have marginal groups really, really trying to speak up and make sure that the greater part of the institution is aware of them, because otherwise people who are at the very center of those institutions, even if they are the most well-meaning individuals, may not even have an opportunity to learn about these things, say, in a university environment.
And we've been talking a little bit about creating awareness, and I think that one of the tools for creating awareness that can also shoot people in the foot a little bit is the media, which is something that I'd like to move into talking about a little bit. And you know, we're part of media right now. We're creating media. Here we are in the studio of a radio station. But queers haven't always been represented in the media in a positive or understanding light. The media is a double-edged sword, as we all know. And it's something that comes up, especially in mainstream media. You know, there's a lot of misrepresentation, and there's also some understanding out there. Every once in a while, you get a breakthrough of something where you're like, wow, they understood what the word, you know, transgendered really means. This is amazing. So I'd just like to ask the question, how are queers represented in mainstream media? Do you feel like this might be changing? Is there any progress happening?
We're all two people, one mic. Too polite. This is a problem. The first thing that came to mind in discussing queer representations in mainstream media, and probably the one that really has been irritating me the most, while there does seem to be increased representation of gay men in the media, I'm really getting sick of them being relegated as the best friend to a straight woman or being treated like an accessory, you know, as opposed to a living, breathing individual with, you know, a fully formed character with their own thoughts, life, as opposed to
Willa Grace.
Will and Grace. Apparently the latest Sex and the City movie, I didn't see it myself because I wouldn't give them money, probably ever. But to my understanding, it's very much about gay men being there for the sake of appearances and for the sake of acting as the best friend, or like I said, more like an accessory than anything.
Right. Also the butch lesbian best friend that, you know, you see that coming up a lot in a lot of movies.
I was going to say, Susan, I don't know if you caught this on the feminist blogosphere, but there was an article in I think Teen Vogue I think it was Teen Vogue recently, that in fact talked about the advent of the gay best friend. So the GBF, which is like
it's an acronym now, so now it's a thing.
And it was talking about how, you know, in Orange County high schools, like, all the girls are like vying for the attention of these guys and like how amazing it is and blah blah blah. And through all of this, I mean, and despite the complete objectification, like, well, okay. But it's not even talking about the gay men in question. It's talking about how great they are for these girls.
So in other words, the fag hag has now turned into gay male best friends. So instead of the women now, like, you know, being counterpart to the gay man is now counterpart to the woman.
I am a handbag.
You're such a pretty handbag.
Why, thank you.
You are a merce, Craig.
Craig, have you ever been put in the role of the GBF?
I mean, nowadays it doesn't really seem to be so much the case. I remember actually having come out in grade 10, one of the girls in my English class, as soon as she found out, just lit up. I was like, great, now I have a gay friend. I was like, oh God, this is not good.
Yeah, this dynamic, the dynamic of the gay man and the straight woman, or the woman, whatever, of any kind, it's a very familiar one to me. It's one that I've played out many, many times since high school. But I don't know, I was always the accessory. I was always the fag hag. But I guess it can go the other way if you're in, your mainstream teen media, too.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was also going to say another problem with media, for me anyway, is that they tend to rely a lot, and this is for all minority groups, they tend to rely a lot on stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you see a gay person portrayed on television, that's basically the summary of their entire personality is gay. And for me, I mean, I've only watched the first half of Glee, but for me, I think Kurt is a really good example of that, wherein he seems to me to be very much every single S to represent fairly well every stereotype about what a gay boy is. And that's not to say that there aren't some gay people like that, but it'd be nice to see more diversity in the representations. And I know Craig is going to disagree because he loves Glee.
I do love Glee, thank you. I do agree on the, for the most part with Kurt, as a character on Glee, is very stereotyped. He's fashionable, he listens to Lady Gaga, he got really excited about, you know, performing Madonna songs, just the whole shebang. But actually, speaking of Lady Gaga, it comes back down to the Lady Gaga episode where... what's his name? The duck guy.
Finn
yeah. who has moved in with Kurt. moved in with Kurt and, you know, gets really angry that he has to share a room with Kurt and, you know, says, I don't want to sleep in this faggy bedroom. I don't want to sleep with this faggy blanket. And Kurt's dad hears this and comes in to speak to Finn and really stands up. And you see Kurt's pain and hurt, but also appreciation for his family supporting him. And so... while the image that he portrays to people at his school is often very much that stereotyped image, he also has that very personal, emotional background with his family, which is something that isn't always represented in media, mm-hmm. Which is good. The other media kind of representation I want to bring it back to as well is we mentioned Will and Grace having, you know, the fag hag, you know, GBF relationship. And at the time, yes, looking back, it's very stereotyped, especially, you know, you look at Jack and he's over the top. But it was a way to really breach the gap to a more mainstream audience. I mean, looking back again, it's easy to critique it and say, yes, it was a terrible thing. It, you know, it just, you know, it's just reinforcing, you know, you're gay-friendly if you watch Will and Grace. However, at the time, it was a way to talk about some of the issues for people.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that I think is happening with the queer community in mainstream media or I guess, gays and lesbians in mainstream media, because that is really what is usually portrayed, is that although there is an increased awareness of them in mainstream media, which is, I think, arguably an achievement all on its own, because there is that awareness there of our community. But at the same time, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because then what has ended up happening is that the portrayals of gays and lesbians in the media has oftentimes been portrayals of people who are acceptable to the mainstream media. So usually white and middle class and otherwise defaulting to sort of the norms of society, so that a show can concentrate on the fact that they are gay or lesbian. And I think that ends up being, in some ways, very detrimental to the community, in terms of creating space for gender variant people, in terms of creating space for people who do not fit into the white, middle class, gender normative, you know, physically attractive mm-hmm. stereotype that is portrayed in media.
Yeah.
Or the goofy stereotype as sort of a foil to that, which is possibly worse.
Right.
And I would just like to say we are mostly speaking about mainstream media. There's a lot of really awesome, I guess, alternative media stuff that does do a fairly good representation of not only various gender identities, but also various gender identities in terms of race and class and things like that. And CGSF, I think, is a good example of a radio station that that doesn't rely solely on stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. And why don't we hear an example of one of the few bands with, you know, queer politics overtly in their music that has ever broken into the mainstream, and that is The Gossip, or Gossip, I think they're now just called. I'm not sure.
Either
I can never keep track of these things. So the song Standing in the Way of Control is the one that that we're going to play, and there's a bit of, you know, there's a bit of an undertone to the song. The Gossip are a group that came out of a sort of, I don't know if I'd say they came out of Riot Grrrl. They're a little late for that, but they've been really active in the Portland community, really active in the queer community, and they're one of the bands that have started to get huge mainstream success, which is surprising to me. But Craig, I know you said some things about this song earlier. Do you want to intro it?
Standing of the Way Controls can probably be actually better introduced by Brittany, so I'll let her go.
Okay.
So the song Standing in the Way of Control that we're going to play was actually written by Beth Dito, the lead singer. She's a lesbian fat activist as well, but she wrote it in response to George Bush's decision to define marriage as solely between a man and a woman, and so this was kind of her response to that action.
Okay, here it is. All right. right. So we're back live here in the studio at CJSF 90.1 FM. And we've been speaking with some folks from out on campus having a roundtable discussion for Pride on queer issues. The song you just heard there was from The Gossip, and that was Standing in the Way of Control. And as we heard from Craig earlier, that was written by Beth Ditto in response to George Bush gay marriage politics. I can't remember all the details. I'm sorry. But that's a great song to illustrate how queers in the media can sometimes represent themselves better than mainstream media can jump in and represent queers. So, yeah, we've been talking a little bit about misrepresentations of queer folks in the media. And one thing I wanted to bring up was a couple weeks ago, there was this whole shebang in the media about Angelina Jolie's daughter, who, and it just kind of like turned my stomach when I watched the footage, because her daughter, you know, likes to dress like a boy. And there was this huge rigmarole in the media about how this was a big deal, and Angelina Jolie was worried that her daughter likes to dress like a boy. And I looked at those pictures of her daughter, and I was like, that's me when I was 8 years old. I dressed like that. Nobody cared. Or if they did care, nobody, you know, it wasn't a big deal. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there for discussion of trans folks in the media and how that's...
Well, with that particular case, I'm not totally informed on all the details, so I might get this wrong, but I believe that that there had sort of been a lot of gender policing of the kid, and eventually she came out and said, leave her alone. Like, there's really absolutely no reason to be worried about any of this. Kids should be able to do what they want, like, dress how they want. It's not a big deal. Like, deal with it.
No, definitely. I really, really hated, though, just from the representation I was seeing. Like, a lot of the headlines were saying things like, Angelina's turning Shiloh into a boy. Because, you know, it's just so easy to turn someone into a different gender by dressing them up.
Right.
And because allowing your child to dress non-gender normatively somehow makes you a really bad parent, right? Like, I mean, it's just, it's kind of ridiculous.
And another thing that I find really interesting is that this discussion, like, apparently kind of ignored the, I guess, traditional role for young girls, which is to be a tomboy. And when I was growing up, there was tons of tomboys, and nobody thought that was weird, or that we were boys, or dressing as boys, or behaving, or tomgirls, sorry, like tomboys, and nobody thought that was weird. And so I think it's interesting that the media is almost decided to erase that, and it seems like now there's gender socialization for girls at a much younger age.
Mm-hmm. And it seems almost that as we've become, or the media has become, a little bit more progressive with representing, you know, straight acting, acceptable gays, there hasn't been a lot of progress in representing folks who don't fall into those, like, acceptable gay categories. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, sort of a battle that's being waged right now that we're seeing played out for a lot of folks. Just to sort of go into the future a little bit, what happens if we do, you know, start winning the battle and mainstream media starts representing a lot more queers, you know, maybe to the percentage that people are actually queer in the population? You're mentioning that CBS, I think you said, has like 20...
No, MTV actually has the most... I forget the exact numbers. It was in the Metro today, but MTV has the most, like, queer positive content. And then I think it was NBC, and then Fox, and then CBS has the least amount.
Wow. There you go. And what happens if those statistics rise and there is a lot of queer positive media and folks represented, you know, in mainstream media? Do you think that's dangerous to have that degree of...
I think it really depends on how queer people in the media are represented. Mm-hmm. And I think that in some ways, there is, as with anything, there is a risk of sort of losing the sort of subculture feel when it is sort of really brought into the mainstream. But that's not necessarily dangerous, I would say. What I would consider more dangerous is the type of gender policing we were just talking about. Is you brought it up actually, and that's quite a hot button issue. Is the straight acting queer people. Mm-hmm. and that is something. There are movements within the queer community that are very, very much about the gender normative gay man and how that's really what's acceptable. And I think that that's tragic. There are not really I can't find words to actually describe how much I dislike this trend, and especially I mean both as someone who is generally sort of more attracted to androgyny and gender non-normative people, but more than that, just as a human being who cares for other human beings' well-being. I mean, it's not something that I find to be an acceptable trend. And I think that if that is perpetuated in mainstream media, that is dangerous for everyone, not just in the queer community, but elsewhere as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we were saying, Brittany mentioned, you know, 27% of MTV apparently is queer positive, but you're looking at what exactly are they defining, and this is Metro, I believe, writing this article, mm-hmm. what do they define as queer positive?
Queer positive, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was based on a study done by GLAAD, which is the gay, lesbian, I forget what the actual acronym is, sorry, but they're a gay and lesbian organization in the States. Mm-hmm. And they did this study, and I guess they were talking about how on MTV there's been a lot of representation in their dance group competition. What's it? So You Think You Can Dance, what is a group?
The... yeah,
so you
that
think
one.
You can dance?
Yeah. It's like troop dancing.
America's Best Dance Crew.
Yeah, that's it. America's Best Dance Crew. Apparently, there's been a lot of gay representation in there. And a few, like, if they're TV shows or reality shows.
Well, I'm glad we can dance.
I'm glad at least that they are, like, the representation is coming from reality TV as much as, you know, we can question how real reality TV is. It's at least showing a bit more of diversity of the queer community. It's mm-hmm. I think the real issue with, you know, sort of like the normative straight acting queer representation is while we're breaking down some of the ideas about queer folks, you know, even though we're relying on a lot of stereotypes, there is still sort of, I think, this underlying understanding that queers are a monolith, you know, like we, like, this is what queer people are,
right,
like,
or we all period. Agree even
exactly, and yeah. it I guess it does ignore a lot of the debate and dissent that even exists within the queer community.
Mm-hmm. And it is important to recognize that yes, there's not always like a unifying topic or theme within the queer community. There is a lot of division in the queer community. However, with certain terms like straight acting, if that's a term that's perpetuated, it's very damaging to everybody, simply because it's just in its own word says that it's not okay to be gay, it's better to be straight. It's right. better to act like a straight person. And in some way, being gay is inferior, and that's not the case. So somebody who is within the queer community, trying to identify without it, but calling people within their own community slurs and names and derogatory terms towards people within their own community, which has already been devalued, but within that community, it's just, it's really, really despicable and low.
Right.
And to see that happen, and then hopefully not be perpetuated in the media, but to see it happening is, it's frightening. Mm-hmm. And so creating more awareness around the diversity and the fact that it's okay to be not straight.
Yeah, and it's okay to, like, you know, not go out and dance and party according to, like, the stereotype of the fact that, you know, all gays can dance. Not true. Not true at all.
There's actually some really interesting academic terms that are coming forth to sort of describe some of these phenomenons. There's the term androphilia, which is a much more positive term for this particular love of very manly men, which is not a particularly palatable term. However, there are some other terms out there that are used. There's sissyphobia, which is sort of the dislike of effeminacy in men. And there's also there's a really, really good queer author, Julia Serrano, who wrote a book called Whipping Girl, and she's a trans woman, and she uses the term effemania to describe this intense devaluing of anything feminine, especially in men, but in women as well. And I think that that book is very, very much worth reading, just for any crash course and sort of...
And worth noting, the book is available at the Out on Campus Library.
Yes, it is.
And what's the name of that book again?
It's called Whipping Girl.
Okay. Good to know. Does anyone else have anything to add on that topic before we move on? I know we've only got about 7 minutes left, so...
I think we probably should move on. Okay. Everyone get through it. Let's go.
Bam, bam. Okay, so let's talk about Pride, because Pride is this week, and Out on Campus is in the Pride Parade. CGSF is also in the Pride Parade. We both got floats. Mm-hmm. Awesome. There's been a lot of discussion over the last few years as Pride becomes bigger and bigger in Vancouver. They're estimating 750,000 people at this year's festival. Mm-hmm. It's also becoming more corporate funded, a little more commercialized. Seems like it has allowed it to grow and get out of debt, which is important, but there's some drawbacks that come with that. So discuss. Craig, you look like you want to say something.
I never know where anybody else wants to talk. We actually had, last night at Out on Campus, a discussion on Pride, and one of the topics that came up was this corporate funding and all these sponsors that are showing up with Pride. And I think, as with anything, it's all in balance and moderation where it's important, because on one hand, yes, there's a need for financial backing to be able to fund the parade, to fund the festivals and the activities that happen, and to make sure that they actually happen, creates more awareness around the issues. But at the same time, one of the biggest faces, I think TD Bank is the number one sponsor for the Pride Parade. When their ads that are supposed to be supporting the Pride Parade, there's this gay couple holding hands, and we do our banking here, we're out in banking, I don't know. Some of their banking ads. When it's primarily advertised in Extra West, which admittedly it's like the gay newspaper or the queer newspaper, I should say, in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And it's not the only place that they advertise. It does show up in, say, the Province and Sun once in a while, but they're not really creating more advertisement around outside of the queer community already. Mm-hmm. It's also ignoring the fact that, the queer community does read other newspapers. We do read things beyond just Extra West. And so if they're trying to only focus on selling themselves to us, they're not really representing or really pushing the envelope and really trying to forward the cause and really be proud of their sponsorship by showing that elsewhere.
With their white middle-class gay couple who banks at TD.
Yeah, I actually wanted to note on the TD, because I go to TD, that's my bank, and my branch at TD actually has the gay ads everywhere in the branch. Now, admittedly, my branch is in Vancouver, so my old branch, which was in Maple Ridge, did not have those ads. That should be noted. But I think in terms of trying to create like an alternative subculture, I think it depends where you want the queer community to go. If you're trying to make an alternative subculture, then having the white middle class gay couple represented on the TD Bank and mortgaging commercials ads is kind of shitty. Personally, I'm like, well, I go to the bank because I have to, but home, North America, it's clearly trying to push gay people into this kind of white picket fence dream of owning a home and having children and getting your mortgage and, moving into this norm that personally does not interest me. But on the other hand, if we want to become more mainstream and more, culturally accepted by everybody, I think that you kind of have to do a trade-off, and in some ways it may mean that the queer community itself gets pushed under underground and remains alternative, and then you have an emergence of, sorry to say it, but the straight gays who do adhere to a middle-class monogamous lifestyle of the white picket fence stream, who get accepted into the mainstream, and then the more alternative perspectives get suppressed or ignored, and everybody's just like, oh, well, we don't actually discriminate against gay people. And that's kind of, in some ways, maybe the nature of capitalism itself. It is only willing to accept people so far as they are willing to buy into the capitalist dream. And if you create a queer community or a group of a community that doesn't agree with that capitalist dream, then you're not going to be accepted.
I was just going to say, just bring it back to Pride, and kind of on the flip side, yes, a lot of sponsors have this kind of not great representation, but at the same time, that's also what the Pride Parade's about, and we'll see that on Sunday. There's, I mean, tons of people just out there really showing their true colors. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a fun festival. It's bright, it's colorful, it's exciting. It's a family event, really, for everybody. Whether you're a partner, you're single, you're with your parents, your children, your friends, just if you're in the parade, you're watching. It's a great way to just celebrate diversity, and you see that clearly in the parade when you see all different groups marching.
And I think it's a really important point to note that that it is about celebrating the diversity rather than just tolerating it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's been an increasing number of straight folks coming out to the Pride Parade, which I think is awesome. Excuse me, I'm going to cough. There we go. And it always, you know, as much as there's this instinct in me to be like, oh, all these corporations throwing free stuff at me, to see all these people cheering and screaming who are allies, mm-hmm. is really, really amazing.
True.
Okay, all done. but I also wanted to briefly bring up the topic of allies and how folks who are listening who may not identify as queer can be better allies to folks who are queer.
Well, I think that as with being allies to any group of people, I think the most important thing to do is listen to the people you know from that group, or actively make an effort to listen to people from that group, either through blogs, through personal experience. And trust me, people, you know someone who is queer. Everybody
yeah,
does.
Even if they don't know it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think probably one of the most important things, and again, as with most, you know, if you're trying to be an ally to most any marginalized community, it's important to not view them as a monolith. You know, like, there's a huge amount of diversity, and not to make assumptions, you know, whether it be about, like, what their orientation means, or about their gender identity, or anything like that. It's, you know, like, if you can ask politely, but don't sit there with your preconceived notions and assume that's what they are because they tell you they're gay.
Okay.
And another, I guess I have 2 points on being an ally. One is specific to the queer community. Sorry, I'm going to try and speed this up. One is specific to the queer community, which is don't make assumptions, and also accept people if they tell you, oh, I identify this way, or actually use the gender pronoun he when you're talking to me, or she, or Z, then respect that. My second point is one more generally. If you're trying to be an ally, oftentimes we internalize, or I've internalized a lot of guilt about the places that I hold privilege. And so try not to be paralyzed by that guilt, and try to understand where you own the privilege and what that privilege does and how it allows you to operate in the world. And that's a really hard thing to work through, and that's going to take a really long time, but try not to allow yourself to be paralyzed by the guilt for holding that privilege.
Thank you so much, Out on Campus. This has been awesome. Democracy Now! Is up next in about 20 seconds. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Any last couple words?
I'd just like to say that there is actually an info session about the Pride, about marching in the Pride Parade this evening at the Out on Campus Lounge at 4:30, if you have any other questions about it, or if you'd like to march but can't come to the parade. There's a Facebook event, and you can email me, Emma, at emn1@sfu.ca for more information.
Thank you so much, and happy Pride.
Happy Pride.